Today is August 28th. We are at the home of Dr. Walter Cooper. I am here with Phyllis Andrews, Richard Peak, Laura Hill, Dr. Walter Cooper.
There must be NAACP information in the Slater papers.
It should be in the Slater papers.
Must be.
Okay, Dr. Cooper. Dick Gregory comes to Rochester.
Well, you have pictures of him. He made Dick Gregory had a performance at the University of Rochester on that evening. And after it was over, we initially gathered at 36 Gregg Street, which was the residence of John and Connie Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Then it was decided that we would go and find something to eat and something to drink. And so the airport had remodeled, and they had a nice restaurant there. And so we went there, and we came in, and we were told that after they saw the crowd, it must have been about 8 or 10 of us, and they said, "We're closed." And at that time, Connie Mitchell, since 1961, had been the representative of the third, had been representative of the third ward in the County Board of Supervisors. And so her name was on the plaque as part of being, you know, involved in the reconstruction of the Rochester Airport. But we were turned down. We couldn't get anything to eat or to drink. And it wasn't late. It might have been, oh, I would say approximately, probably 10:30 or so, 10:30 to 11 o'clock p.m. But I maintained contact with Dick Gregory, and by 1969, he was part of a committee that I chaired in Washington, D.C., which was part of the Small Business Administration. At that time, the Johnson administration had named Howard Samuels, a local person, as to head up the Small Business Administration. And he made a request to Eastman Kodak that he would like for me to come down as a special consultant to the administrator. So I cleared it with my family and went to Washington in 1969 and was attached to the Small Business Administration. And so I will complete this when I come back. I was expecting an important call.
So you press record, and it puts it on. Yes, I don't know if you recall, but that's Jay Shulman, who was a sociology professor at Cornell or Ithaca. Chris Lindley referred to him.
Mm-hmm. I do remember.
I remember Jay.
Yeah, he did a lot of, there was a lot of newspaper things around him, a lot of reports.
Where is Jay now? Is he still alive?
I have tried to locate him. He did some stuff in New York City recently, but I can't find any, you know, any information on him.
Did you contact Cornell?
No, it's likely they would have, you know, alumni or, sure, you know, past faculty information or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I certainly couldn't find it in a Google search. But Mr. Price had other pictures of him. He allowed me to.
This is you showing us from Price.
This is from Price. Yeah.
Here, I'll take that. That's something I haven't hung as yet. It's from my granddaughter.
Oh.
Ninth grader.
Well, Laura, do you want me to call Cornell?
I mean, that would be fantastic. I think he would be a great person to touch base with. I mean, if you knew somebody there that could,
yeah,
get you the information.
Sure.
He got involved in some legal cases. I mean, testifying on behalf of some group or... I was moving through the material quickly, but he was in New York City last I could find something publicly on him.
Mm-hmm.
It's
wasn't exactly clear to me where. So you didn't finish saying with the Dick Gregory what you guys ended up doing about it.
Well, there was a lots of discussion whether we should pursue with the State Commission Against Discrimination, the person who directed that, whom I knew, Elmer Carter, who was an intellectual, and he was from Auburn, New York. But it kind of fizzled out, and we didn't file any suit or any complaint with the State Commission Against Discrimination. Bill Knox had known Elmer Carter, I think, at Harvard. But Elmer Carter is mentioned in Myrdal's American Dilemma, because he was one of the leaders who was the government threatened to arrest during World War II for what they considered to be activity not in the best interest of the government. And it was civil rights activity. It was a bunch of them whom they had listed: A. Philip Randolph, Elmer Carter, and some others.
What year was the airport incident?
That was 1964, I believe, wasn't it?
It's here somewhere.
Yeah, the data's on it. I'm almost certain it was 1964. And Dick Gregory had appeared at an event at the University of Rochester.
So at this time, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Richard.
So at this time, is Gregory's act leaning towards the political?
Not necessarily. He was more of a comedian than he was a political activist. Yeah.
I think John Mitchell was telling us. Is it the Selma March?
Dick Gregory went on that.
Dick Gregory was,
but he was not really the active voice in civil rights. He picked that up later. He was a little younger. He had been a track and field star at the Southern Illinois in Carbondale, Illinois, and his stick at that time was primarily being a comedian. But it was not uncommon for celebrities who didn't head up civil rights organizations to appear at civil rights marches and so forth, like Harry Belafonte and others, mm-hmm. to lend their support, not necessarily to lead. So, and I think Dick Gregory at that time was it. But by the time 1969 came around, he was, avid out front in terms of economic development and other problems associated with minorities in this country.
Phyllis, when we spoke with Loma Allen, did you have any idea how instrumental she was with the Urban League?
No.
She was a founding member of the Urban League.
Was she?
Her name is all over everything, and she so downplayed that mm-hmm. in the interview, and I didn't know.
Yeah, she was a founding member. She, Manny Goldman, mm-hmm. the Goldman family was very active. Jane and Manny. Mm-hmm. Manny Goldman and Dr. Knox were very close friends.
Manny's the attorney.
Yeah, he was the attorney.
Okay.
Both of them have passed. Mm-hmm. I should have. Jane later wrote a kind of a history of her family. And the family was traditionally a liberal family. And I think, if my memory is correct, I think in 1924, the City Club invited W.E.B. Du Bois to give a talk, and the Goldman family hosted W.E.B. Du Bois, so who was, the premier visionary leader among African Americans.
And how old is he at this point?
Who?
Du Bois.
Du Bois died on August 26th or 27th, on the eve of the Civil Rights Movement, on the eve of the March on Washington. They announced that at the March on Washington, the MC said, "I regret to give you some bad news. Yesterday evening, W.E.B. Du Bois died in Craw, Ghana. He had gone to Africa to put together Encyclopedia Africana, mm-hmm. a complete history of Africans and African Americans. But Du Bois has class. He was a graduate of Harvard, the first black PhD at Harvard in 1896. His thesis, which he put into a book, is number one in the Harvard classics, and it was called "Suppression of the African Slave Bull," by W.E.B. Du Bois. And he was the one to do the first sociological study of black families in the United States, the Philadelphia Negro. He was also a moving figure for the Niagara Movement, 1905. A group of black intellectuals met on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls because they could not get reservations on the U.S. side. And so you had Monroe Trotter, W.E.B. Du Bois, and all of the, what I would call, college-trained blacks who were interested in civil rights. And Du Bois then became one of the leading figures in the founding of the NAACP in 1909, along with Chevis Wallen, Mary White Ovington, and others.
Before he's kicked out twice for being a communist.
And he wrote great books, The Philadelphia Negro, Dusk of Dawn, but his classic is The Souls of Black Folk, 1903.
Have you read Black Reconstruction?
I have it, yes, I've read it, yes.
800 pages? The man needed an editor.
Yeah, he needed an editor. I have most of his books that he published because he was one of my, I admired him because he came along and he was right on the money in a lots of thought and philosophies which neither whites and too many blacks did not believe. For example, he didn't believe that the philosophy of Booker T. Washington would get us where we needed to go. Mm-hmm. And he was right because Booker T. Washington gave his famous Atlanta Convention talk in 1895, and then in 1896 you had Plessy versus Ferguson, which solidified the doctrine of separate but equal in the United States at a time when they had essentially eliminated the possibility of well-trained blacks being integrated into the industrial economy. For example, at Manumission of Freedom in 1865, out of 120,000 black skilled workers in the South, over 100,000 of them were black. They were your plumbers, your masons, your electricians, all of them. But the Industrial Revolution started impacting this country in 1855. And so, but these men and a few women were not integrated into the growing industrial economy. And really the first cracks for blacks into the industrial economy did not take place until around 1913, when the miners in Kentucky and West Virginia went on strike, and H.L. Frick, Andrew Carnegie, and other industrialists made an appeal to Booker T. Washington. He said, bring the blacks from the South and you won't have any more strikes. So they were used as strike breakers in the coal industry. That's 1913. So, you know, lift up your buckets where they are. Philosophy of Booker T. Washington didn't work. Frame your hands, not your minds.
But, I mean, at the same time, I think Booker T. Washington gets a bum rap.
I'm not bum rapping. I'm talking about his conflict with W.E.B. Du Bois.
The philosophy that he espoused was not the same as what he was doing in his private life and with his resources. I mean, he really, these organizations that he took on and that he publicly spatted with, he was sending checks to,
oh, sure,
you know, behind the
scenes. National Business League, for mm-hmm. example. But he, But I think the damage done was he crystallized, and this was the follow-up of the his Atlanta exposition talk of 1895 that particularly led to attitudes that created the Plessy book versus Ferguson, mm-hmm. a Supreme Court decision, separate but equal, and it was by no means equal, because in the early 1900s, there was a county in Georgia which refused to provide any provision for a black school, and the blacks took it to the court system, I think all the way to the Supreme Court, and they lost the case. They had no school in that county. And so it set into motion, really, crystallized school segregation and as a way of life. I personally feel that, and I think I've expressed this to you before, that from a historical perspective, whites North and South like to look at the Civil War solely in terms of freeing the slave, but actually the Civil War was necessary to maintain the integrity of the Republic, of the country itself, as a unified entity in terms of the governing process. But I think both North and South, they like to believe that they slaughtered one another, forgetting the 180,000 blacks who fought in the Union Army. Mm-hmm. They like to believe that they slaughtered each other just to free the slaves, and that was not it at all. Mm-hmm. And that's why you will not find in history book that will ever call Robert E. Lee, Andrew Jackson, a traitor. And these were men who were educated at West Point, were on the federal payroll, and then turned around and fought against their country. A postdoc at the University of Rochester in the physics department, whom I befriended, a fellow by the name of Baldini from Italy, he asked me one time, he said, why doesn't your history books, American history, call these men traitors? He said, when I was taught American history in Italy, you know, the book said, well, they were traitors to their country. And this is true. So I think you get a different perspective. And that's why I was glad that I allowed myself experiences with a large number of students from all over the world, because you get a different insight into America viewed through their eyes and not through the eyes of those who live here. Much like the Rosenwald Foundation, when they provided the money to commission Gunnar Myrdal to put out the American Dilemma.
There's a program called Camura, CAMURA. It's some kind of a business, it looks like.
It was for camera repair.
But it's not in Rochester. It's south of here somewhere, Livingston County. Do I have it wrong?
Well, originally we set it up to take advantage of introducing blacks to small business. Mm-hmm. Who ran it? Was it the?
It's Urban League, I think.
I know, but I'm talking about the director of it. The last name was Mars, who was. His father had been minister of a church, but I think they were Narragansett Indian in background.
Okay.
So we decided to. We always had a business interest because we had on the board an economist, Marcus Alexis, who was the first black tenured professor at the University of Rochester in its economics department. In 1963, Dr. Marcus Alexis. He later left. He was the one who chaired the. He was the second president of the Rochester Urban League, and he chaired the. He was a primary participant in the Black Family Conference, which we ran in October 1969.
Is his family still in Rochester?
No, Alexis' family originally came out of Brooklyn. He was educated at Michigan State in the late 40s, and he received his doctorate in economics, I think, from the University of Minnesota. I think I have a bio on him somewhere in my files. No, they're in, okay. In another place. I know where to put my hands on them.
I came across the Knox file.
Knox, yeah.
But not the...
Knox was an interested Alexis. Man, and I don't know why a street was not named after him. He or Tom Boyd, who was the architect. Mm-hmm. Knox came out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. There were three boys and two girls. All three boys received PhDs from Harvard. Knox started Harvard in 1921, and he, when he showed up at his dorm, they had made a mistake. He was not supposed to be enrolled in the dorm because at that time Harvard did not allow its black students to live in the dorms on campus. So he had to find residence with a black family out in the community of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so he graduated from there, and at that time there were blacks in the Ivies, and they got to know each other. He overlapped Ralph Bunch there. There was a person, oh God, what was his name? I knew his grandson. But the blacks of the Ivies, Brown, Yale, and Harvard particularly, tended to get to know each other. Knox, after he got his bachelor's, he taught and did summer work at MIT, where he got a master's in chemical engineering in 1925. And in 1935, he received a PhD in physical chemistry from MIT. During World War II, he was assigned to the Manhattan Project at Columbia University. His boss was Willard F. Libby, who later won a Nobel in chemistry for carbon-14 dating techniques. Knox was the head of a small group that had the responsibility of isolating pure uranium from uranium hexafluoride, and they carried that out successfully. And so at the end of the war, Willard F. Libby promised all of his workers that he would try to place them either in academia or in a corporate research setting. So he called C.E. Kenneth Meese, who at that time was director of research at Eastman Kodak Company, and told C.E. Kenneth Meese he had an outstanding scientist whom he thought would be good for Eastman Kodak Company. And he said, but he's a person of color. I want you to know that up front. See, Kenneth Meese said, told him that he as long as he's a good scientist, color is meaningless. So Knox came to Kodak in 1945. He faced a terrible housing situation. He kept his furniture in storage for about 2 or 3 years before he could find a decent place to live. The real estate board offered him an abandoned house of prostitution on Joseph Avenue. And of course he didn't take it. And around 1946 or 47, he had a colleague in the chemistry division of Eastman Kodak Company, by a physicist by the name of Donald Morey, M-O-R-E-Y. And Donald Morey agreed to act as his power of attorney. He bought a place for Knox on Woodman Park, I think 28 Woodman Park, and Knox and his family moved in there.
Does he still have family in Rochester?
No.
No.
No, he retired. He spent, he retired from Eastman Kodak in 1965 or 1966. He was the company's expert on surface active agents, surfactants. He finished Kodak with probably 27 patents. He stayed here for a while. He was, as I mentioned, he was the first president of the Urban League, and he actually involved himself in lots of other activities. But unfortunately, and I say this, like, the community still did not have anything, you know, employment opportunities for him. And so his daughter, Sandra, lived in West Newton, Massachusetts. So he and his wife eventually went to West Newton, Massachusetts. And he was there until he died in 1995. The American Chemical Society asked me to write an obituary for him, and I needed a picture. I wanted to show a picture of him. And so I called the Urban League. I was long removed from it by that time. This was July 1995, and I knew in the boardroom there was a picture of Dr. Knox, and so I didn't have a 5x7, so I said, I'd come down to the office, pick up the 5x7, and then I would have prints made in return. The executive director, who's still there, Bill Clark, said, no, you don't have to do that. I will, have prints made and deliver them to you. So here it is in 2008, and I still don't have the prints. That gives you some idea of the efficiency of the Urban League. But Knox was a real great guy. Humor, had great humor, and he'd like to tell the story how he was, when he was teaching at the black colleges and universities in the South. I think one year he was at Shaw University, and they had a dean by the name of West. Dean West was dean of the men of the college, but he was also professor of English. And so Dean West took it upon himself to get rid of the gambling in the men's dorm, particularly on weekends. So this one Saturday he goes to the men's dorm, and one of the rooms had its transom was open, and he said, well, I got him now. He heard him inside, said, baby, need a new pair of shoes, 7x11, or so forth like that. So he knocks on the door, boom, 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 boom. The guy's in there, who in the hell is it? He said, it's me, Dean Knox. The guy said, you're a damn liar. If it were Dean Knox, he would say, it is I. And the dean walked away sheepishly. So he would regale you with his experiences at these colleges. He was interesting. He taught physical chemistry at Tougaloo during one of his stints. And he said the way he taught those kids was he wouldn't have a large class, of course, maybe 8 or 9 students in physical chemistry. And he would call them into his office and say, sit down. Well, he'd sit down and get them comfortable, and he said, well, go to my board and put down the second law of thermodynamics and explain it to me. And so that's the way he taught, and the students loved him. And one of his top students, oh God, what was his name? He went to the University of San Francisco in California, became quite a prominent man in the field of biochemistry. Yeah. But he was a great man. He had two brothers. Larry Knox had a bachelor's from Bates, a master's from Stanford, and a PhD from Harvard in chemistry. He ended his career by working for, I think, one of the pharmaceuticals that had an office and operation in Mexico City. And I met him, but he died relatively young, I guess, probably of carbon monoxide poisoning at the fireplace. But he lived in Mexico City. Everett Clinton Knox was a Phi Beta Kappa out of Williams College and a PhD under Schlesinger Sr. at Harvard with a specialty in Far Eastern Studies, Eastern European Studies. He was part of the U.S. delegation in San Francisco to formulate the principles of the United Nations. He later joined the U.S. Department of State, held ambassadorships in Honduras, Dahomey, which is now Benin in West Africa, and ended his career with a ambassadorship to Haiti. Two sisters, Stella and what was his other sister's name? Well, Stella and, we communicated for years. Stella and, I can see her face. Well, anyway, Stella became, I think, a nurse. His other sister was brilliant. Bill claimed she was the smartest one in the family. She became a school teacher and lived in New Jersey for many years and then died. Yeah. But he showed me he was a great nephew of Harriet Jacobs, the writer. His middle name was Jacob, William Jacob Knox, and it was due to the relationship, familial relationship with Harriet Jacobs, the writer. Knox's grandfather had secured his manumission papers in Alamance County, North Carolina, I believe, in 1849. So it's a family rich in history, and I'm surprised no one has written a book on the Knox family.
Are you familiar with the Sister Cities program?
Yes.
In Rochester?
Yes.
Dr. Cooper has file after file after file after file on the things he's set up here.
Well, I gave Phyllis the kind of chronology of my activities with the Bamako Rochester Sister City Committee, and also a report on spending 6 weeks in Sub-Saharan Africa in 1977, visiting countries and dignitaries. So it was interesting. So I have plenty more down the basement. If you ever run out of things, I have plenty for you yet.
That's good news.
So you can make a career out of going through my files.
No, well, Dr. Cooper, I can make several people's careers of going through your files. It's absolutely unbelievable to me. I like, at this point, I'm liking when I get to a science file because I'm like, oop, not my project.
Well, it's
not your project, but that doesn't mean that there's not a place for them in the archive.
Oh, no. It's all going.
No.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm amazed at the breadth of
my participation.
Your participation.
A to Z.
The breadth of your memory is outstanding.
I know.
Isn't that sick?
Clementine was his sister's name.
There's something wrong with you. Here you go. Here's where you move from the New Rochelle case to bringing your own.
Yeah.
The significance of the New Rochelle school decision.
Yep. 1959. Paul Zuber. Big, tall guy.
Right.
Deep voice. Yes. Paul Zuber. He later ended up at RPI as kind of a special in law and mentor for minority students. He was, I think he was a graduate of Brown University originally, and then I've forgotten where he went to in law school. See, those days you had people like Baker Motley, the woman judge, Constance Baker Motley. These were the days where early in Rochester in the early 60s, Reuben Davis was counsel for the NAACP. But we had to use the state NAACP to file the suit because the president, Father Primo, dug his heels in and would not permit it to take place. He said he would not embarrass his friends downtown, Elmer Milliman and others. Then once we won the suit, Jerry Balter, who was an engineer and he worked for old Stromberg Carlson, had suggested that we have get the districts and the suburban districts, the pie-shaped kind of situation where you'd have each one getting a slice of part of the Rochester district, but it went nowhere. But that was advocated in early 1964.
I did not know that there was an organized committee, Citizens for Abolition of Police Advisory Board.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was the counterstroke. See, what was interesting those days, you had the participation of young, educated blacks and whites. For example, the Connie Mitchell campaign was pushed by myself and Professor Richard Wade from the University of Rochester. And so you had students from the University of Rochester plus young, professionally trained blacks who were part of an organization called the Delta Resix, and some of the young black students and white students who were school teachers and others. You can't get a school teacher involved now. They won't do a thing. You don't see, to me, any kind of change has to be driven by an educated group of young people between the ages of 20 and 35. They have the idealism, they have the energy, and they have the vigor to do so. And they have the courage. When you don't have young people participating, then your community's in trouble. And that's where we are today.
Yet another good reason to have your papers at an institution where they can be made accessible and preserved, and young people can continue to use them.
One of the problems we face, though, is you take African Americans, they don't like to talk about history, especially slavery. And my contention is they don't want to talk about slavery because they see some of the socio-psychology of the slave plantation as being akin to condition of the contemporary American, African American. You know, that's, I got some, well, I taught one day a week students at, high school students, black high school students at St. Simon's Episcopal Church when it was over at 6 1/2 Oregon Street. And everything was okay until I start talking about slavery. Didn't want to talk about it. Kwame Anthony Appiah, APPIAH, who teaches at Princeton, about 8 months ago, he had an article in the magazine section of the Sunday's New York Times, and he talked about some of the history of his native country, Ghana, with reference to the most dominant ethnic group or tribe there, the Ashanti. What he wanted to do is, the Ashanti held slaves, African slaves, up until 1808, when the British outlawed slavery in the colonies. So Appiah wanted to find out, what's 200 years removed, what's the relationship of the descendants of the former slaves to the Ashanti today? What is their attitude? Much to his chagrin and actual surprise, he found that the descendants of the slaves had essentially the same attitude toward the Ashanti today than their enslaved forefathers had. They showed deference, considered themselves inferior, had lack of cooperation with one another within their own group. So Appiah said, how can this be? And he concluded that it's a conditional response passed on from generation to generation as if it's transcripted in their DNA. So if you look at any description of the slave plantation in the United States, whether it's by Eugene Genovese, David Breon Davis, E. Franklin Frazier, John Hope Franklin, pardon me, all the historians of slavery and their description of the slave plantation. Then you look at contemporary African Americans, you see the same traits. Self-hatred, lack of suspicion of one another, lack of cooperation with one another, and an inability to really to deal with the reality of their situation. And I think it's the psychological chains of slavery that inhibit or prevents a large number of blacks from achieving. And the great tragedy is they don't know that those psychological chains are still there. See, it's not another program that will transform the lives dramatically. What's really needed are excellent psychiatrists and good mental health workers, because it's mental. And I don't think anyone has readily written an article on the phenomena which I call place, which is deeply embedded in lots of African Americans. That is, there's a certain place for me in this community and where I am, and I don't transgress that place. And that's why you don't, the connectivity of black families or guardians to institutions is fragile, because the psychological barrier of place. And that's why even on university campuses, you get a limited number of black students in particular who do not participate in study abroad. You can't get them to go. It's place. They don't see themselves being everywhere within a community where they live, and they don't see themselves within the construct of the world. They don't understand it. And I don't think you have many people on college campuses who can relate it to them, because lots of the minority professors are still caught into place themselves. Not totally liberated in the mind. And that's what you have to have. You have to see yourself as part of the global world. If you don't, then you've set limitations on what you can do and where you can go and your overall quality of life. You see, people have to understand, if they make the decision to try to live in homogeneous communities, they're setting limitations on what they can do, because the world moves toward a greater heterogeneity. And people who are dedicated to homogeneous communities and experiences, they are living in the past. So, you know, and I don't think it's not taught in our churches, it's not taught in our schools. And it's always, it resolves itself to leadership.
Well, it's certainly not taught in the schools. And if you're going to bring in the mental health workers, you have to start working with the students.
Yeah. See, the problem in Rochester, and I've been involved in the schools since 1960, when I protested as chairman of the Education Committee, the NAACP, an administration decision to place 900 students out of schools 3, 4, and 19 on half-day sessions. Mm. And my approach, not once did I mention race, because only at that time only about 35% of the students were of color. But we were only 3 years removed from the Russians orbiting Sputnik. And so you had a great thrust in the United States to revitalize our educational system, especially math, science, and technology, because of the potential threat of the Soviet Union. So my statement before the board was, it's imperative that we provide a full-day educational experience for these students, because we have to better educate all of our students. And these students need more, not less, education, not only for their future, but also for the future of the community and the country. And the newspaper came out and said that I charged the board with racial discrimination. Not once did I use race. That's the way the newspapers did it.
I just saw a headline, three Negro leaders claim racial bias in school plan.
Yeah. So my boss at Kodak was all upset and everything. I lost a wage increment that year. Not because of my productivity in terms of science and technology, but because of that. 1968, July 7th, 1968. At that time, you had a very good, you want a stool, I can get you a stool.
No,
we had a very intelligent president of the Board of Education, Judge Jacob Gittleman. He was a member of the Mensa Society. So I called him up, made an appeal. I said, hey, let's have lunch and let's discuss this. And on August 20th, 1960, and you can check this in the official transcribed minutes of the Board of Education, Jacob Gittleman was able to get his colleagues to rescind the administration decision. Now, but if you look at the quality of leadership on the Board of Education, and I've tried to get someone to do a study on this from 1960 to the year 2000, you will see a devolution or a decrease in the quality of leadership on the Board of Education. So the leadership quality goes downhill, and the performance quality of the students goes downhill likewise. You have to have leadership. And of course, there are other factors that go into this. You know, the studies show, the Coleman's report of 1966, a 10-year study, over 100,000 students, parents, administrators, teachers, show that in the final analysis, the family is the primary determinant of educational achievement. The late 1990s early childhood longitudinal study run by the Federal Department of Education just substantiates the Coleman study. It involved 20,000 students, 5,000 parents or guardians. And what they concluded, you could look at student achievement and it will tell you much about the family. There was a direct correlation between student achievement and family stability and involvement in the educational lives of their children. I'm a firm believer that we've lost generations. We may be able to salvage a small percentage of those youngsters who are in middle school and high school now. But if I had my money and if I had my druthers, I would focus on the parents and guardians of youngsters between the ages of 0 and 6. If you're going to really solve the problem of education in Rochester and other communities of this country, particularly urban communities. You have to be deeply concerned given the demographics and given the fact that where are you going to get competent people to lead our institutions? In New York State, the public education involves a little over 2.8 million students. 44% of those students are minorities. 67% of the minority students are educated in our 5 urban districts. So if your urban districts are not doing well in achievement, your minority students are not doing well. Simple rule of thumb. But look, who supports this, though? You have a radio station, WDKX, you know, lots of lip service to rights and everything. I was a regent for 9 years, followed by Professor Ina Farley from Brockport, also a Jamaican-born person, but an African-American citizen, followed by the present regent, Dr. Milton Cofield. He's been there 6 years. So you add up my 9, Ina Farley's 5, Cofield 6. So you're talking about essentially 20 years, okay? 20 years where you've had the representative of the 7th Judicial District on the Board of Regents being a person of color. Not once were we ever interviewed to talk about education on the black radio station, WDKX. So it's just farcical. Not once were we invited by the so-called community organization to talk about education. Not once were we invited by a traditional black church to talk about education. So, but they'll tell the community how greatly they're involved with the community and how they're interested in the mental and physical well-being of the community. So it's all lip service. Like I told the mayor, I said, you know, if black ministers come to you and they want to make a contribution, you just tell them they can do two things. One, their church should have a library run by a competent person. Secondly, they should periodically use as their text on Sunday morning the book of Hosea, the 4th chapter, the 6th verse, which states emphatically, "My people perish for lack of knowledge. If ye reject knowledge, therefore ye reject me." It's that simple. They aren't going to do it. Like voter registration. If you could get voter registration Sunday by every black church and each one commit themselves to canvassing 1 square mile from where they're located, you could probably register 8,000 to 10,000 people. It's that simple. See, my anger is the mechanism is there, but the will and the commitment and the knowledge is not.
What do you think the voter turnout will be for Obama?
Well, I hope good, but it's estimated that there are 500,000 blacks who are eligible to vote who are unregistered. So, but it'll be pretty high. You know, they'll vote for him. And I think it'll be a good thing. He has all the qualifications, much much better qualified than George W. Bush was. But I think the election will tell you lots about the status of the American people as it relates to race relations. See, one of the problems in this country, we never had a true dialogue on race. Neither blacks or whites have been interested in it to the degree that they should be. For example, when Clinton became president, he took the prominent, well-respected John Hope Franklin as a historian to head up a commission on racial reconciliation to go around the country to talk about issues of race from community to community. It was a failure because neither blacks or whites want to talk about race. I used to give talks as early as 1960, Black History Month, maybe a subject would be Africans and African-Americans, the commonality of the colonial experience. So after the presentation, even professionally trained blacks, I could hear them say, well, they ought to take Cooper, put him in a box and ship him back to Africa. 10 years later, they were wearing the dashikis and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
What connection have you had with the Frederick Douglass Institute at
none.
The University of Rochester?
None, because I'll tell you why. When Maxine Childress Brown got the money from Xerox, I was still on the Board of Regents to set up a Frederick Douglass Institute. Okay? They never asked me to participate, and I'll go and get some background for you on that issue also. I knew a member who was on her board, and I said, well, look, if it's going to be educationally oriented or even a museum, it has to get a temporary permission from the Board of Regents. You know, all of these institutions, 7,000 libraries and museums in the state, all have permission and certification from the Board of Regents. Okay. So, I told this person that, and they kind of ignored it. They were not legally equipped to develop a museum or an institute, even though they had the money. Maxine Childress Brown, a member of the city council, teacher at SUNY at Brockport. She did not have sense enough to look into the legal aspects of the provisions by the state of New York for running an institute, museum, or an educational institution, much like a healthcare institution. But that didn't surprise me, because earlier, around 1979, is that right? Yeah. Madison High School was having problems with achievement level of its students. Someone decided to have a Madison High School Revitalization Committee. So, of course, I wasn't on it. I didn't know anything about education, according to the community leaders. But I was the only one who had been actively involved in educational issues through chairing the Ralph Bunch Committee, Scholarship Committee, and doing other things under the NAACP and also Urban League. So I asked this person who was on the committee, I said, well, what are they considering? He said, well, they want to bring in a consultant for a week and have the consultant write the blueprint for revitalizing educational achievement. So I said, well, why don't you consider bringing in Kenneth Clark, the educational psychologist from New York City, City College of New York. You know, he runs now MARC, Metropolitan Applied Research Corporation. He has a wealth of knowledge about education of black children. He and his wife, Mamie Phipps Clark, had done some of the sterling studies on black children in Harlem and their learning and so forth. This guy said, well, that's a good idea. And I said, if they don't want to go that route, why not take some of the people who were involved in trying to revitalize the American educational system post-Sputnik years? Jerome Kagan from Harvard, Gerald Zachariasen, the physicist from MIT. Or have a combination of them come in and let them look it over and then make a recommendation. So I even went and got a short resume, a brief bios of these people and gave it to this individual. So they chose Jesse Jackson. He came in for a week, up with hope, down with dope, and all that kind of talk, and the school closed a year and a half later. So as long as people reject knowledge, they're forever going to find themselves in the conundrum.
I have a photograph in the archive, and it would be from the late 1940s or early 1950s, if I'm judging the dress of the students. They're all very nattily dressed, coats mm-hmm. and ties, and they're sitting in some impressive room, like the Wells Brown Room, but it's not the Wells Brown Room. And the man they're listening to, I think, is John Hope Franklin.
That's right. That's the Sidney Hillman lecture. I was right there.
Bingo.
Sidney Hillman, and later the next year they brought in Connor Cruz O'Brien, the Irish intellectual who was an educator. At one time, Connor Cruz O'Brien had been Chancellor of the University of Ghana. He had run the Ghanaian system. And later he became Ireland's UN representative. Yeah, Connor Cruz O'Brien, Sidney Hillman Lectures at the University of Rochester.
Thank you.
And John Hope Franklin.
Thank you. I've gone through the student newspapers.
No, that was it, the Sidney Hillman Lectures. The Sidney Hillman Lectures was actually, the proponents of it were she was taught at Cornell, and her husband was the historian, Dr. McKelvey,
mm-hmm. Sure.
His wife, and a member of the union hierarchy here, a woman by the name of Alice Grant. Yeah.
Did you just think that it was John Hope?
Because it looks like a young John Hope Franklin.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I was there. I was there. At the dinner.
I've shown it around to people, and they say, oh, I never heard of John Hope.
They don't have a historical memory. See, in Sakharov, the Russian dissidents, people without a historical memory are doomed to degradation.
And that's true.
Did you work with Joe Wilson?
There's a letter in the files from Joe Wilson. I got to know Joe Wilson during maybe a year before he died, but I knew Joe Wilson, and he was interested and he had done remarkable things. The Urban League used to have VIP luncheons and breakfasts, and Joe Wilson was invited, Don Gaudian, who ran Cybron Corporation. A founding member of the Urban League was John Learmakers, who was the senior vice president for the research labs at Eastman Kodak Company. So we had a very great, very strong, and a spectrum of influential people on the founding members of the Urban Board. George Engel, who for years had been associated with the university, Loma Allen, Manny Goldman, Dr. William E. Lee, Dr. Kenneth Woodward, the pediatrician, myself, Catherine Terrell, Dr. Marcus Alexis. So it was there. You should have letterhead with those people's names on it.
Did you tell me that you had Catherine Terrell's phone number?
I could find it for you. But she's almost house bedridden, and I don't know whether you'll get accurate information from her. I don't know, but I'll find it for you. Catherine Terrell had come on the scene as kind of a citizen's advisory to ABC, the founding of ABC. Mm-hmm. You'll see that in mm-hmm. the ABC material.
Oh, that's the other agency, Phyllis, you could maybe do a section on is ABC.
The anti-poverty program.
Yeah.
That big bound volume, mm-hmm. that's the beginning of it. In six from
well, that's the a branch, big the, branch application.
Right, and the other one was on a proposal that was never funded because the incoming executive director, whether he was lazy or whether it was by intent, never sent it to Washington.
So you have the grant that he just described
that did get funded.
Yeah.
No. The one he just said
the folder, the one that Small Business Development Corporation. To be funded for $91,000.
The ABC proposal, that was first formed, I think is the other one that I had. They weren't identical.
They're different.
Dr. Cooper, how is next Friday for you?
Freitag is that I have to be in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
What date is that? The 4th or 5th? I have to be in Pittsburgh.
You're there the 4th also?
Yeah, I think so, because being the patron of the family, I'm the one with the responsibility, and I have to get grave markers for two aunts who died within the last 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. All right, we can talk later then.
Oh, we can talk.
Are you talking about a return visit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you plan it for the week after the 5th?
Sure.
While you look at that. Sure. I'll get you.
Is there a day you were thinking?
I am out of town the 3rd, 4th, 5th of Friday,
mm-hmm.
and then the 8th.
Okay. I teach on Tuesday, so that doesn't work, but I'm open here Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
I'd love to come back. If you don't mind me coming back.
I don't mind a bit.
I'd love it.
Very flip-flop.
Oh,
way back in 1942-43 in junior high school. So he really gets PO'd every time he reads about the Fosbury flop. So I said, well, Lamb, I call him Lamb. He lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I said, well, I'll write track and field news and try to correct that. And so I just sent an email to the editor of track and field news. And I told him, I said, any devotee of track and field, and some are still living in western Pennsylvania, they can attest to the fact that he used the back flop for high jumping. And he set a junior high record. We were eighth graders, I believe, or ninth graders. Must have been eighth graders, of 5'7". And I set a record in the fifth. They used to run outdoor 50-yard dash, so I ran a 50-yard dash in 5.6 seconds And it's mentioned in the article. So I was pretty fast. Yeah.
You were very fast.
Very fast. Exactly.
He would like a separate section on his athletic accomplishments in the archive.
Yeah, I went to college on an academic football scholarship.
Yes, I remember you telling us
that. Well, I made, you'll see some of it in the video that they're putting together for the Frederick Douglass affair. They have a picture of me in a football uniform.
I have a picture of my dad like that. What number were you?
I think I was number 18.
My dad was 44, and he used that number for everything the rest of his life.
He couldn't use Jim Brown's 32. Or what was Ernie Davis's number? I forgot.
He's an Elmira guy.
Huh?
He was from Elmira.
Oh, yeah, he was a great guy.
Did he go to Syracuse after that?
Syracuse, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then he was drafted by the Browns and never played a game because he died of leukemia.
That's right. Yeah.
It's just tragic. Ernie Davis,
The Ernie Davis Center in Elmira.
Yeah. Just a wonderful human being. Yeah. Died very young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ernie Davis.